Mathematica is very happy to do you for you very quickly, and Callum wants to tell me something I can tell.
Chicken, you might have thought.
Okay.
Today's tutorials are going to be really weird. It turns out where everyone has to go and get to TV testing.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're going to tell you about that later. There's something you have to go to the. Well, I'll tell you later. But, yeah, this afternoon's going to be weird.
Why don't you tell them now?
I can't remember what it is yet.
Are they going to have any GR tutorial this afternoon?
We haven't figured that out yet.
Okay. Okay. Sure. Going back to Mathematica or Maple, I mean, Maple is my tool of choice, but Mathematica seems to be the easiest thing to do this week. What I'm going to suggest is that everybody who has received in their email a Mathematica license, does not have Mathematica installed, please bring your laptop tomorrow. And during the tutorials, hopefully there are tutorials tomorrow. Excellent. During the tutorials tomorrow, I'll try and arrange to have one of the IT people here, and she can help you install Mathematica. And that will be a very useful thing for various exercises or calculations that you might want to do for relativity in this course or in future courses or elsewhere. In any event, we were going to move on this week. So last week, what we had been studying is the motion of geodesics, or test particles, in the Schwarzschild space-time. And I basically just handed you the Schwarzschild space-time, and this is said that this is the Coulomb solution of Einstein's theory of general relativity. And that allowed us to think about a lot of interesting physics. In particular, we covered some of the tests of general relativity, solar system tests of general relativity, and we heard about some interesting physics. But it might have been somewhat unsatisfying to be told that this is the solution of some set of equations that I haven't told you what they are. And so that's what we would like to do this week, is we'd like to try and understand what are the equations that are going to replace Newton's equations for the gravitational field. So this is what Newton wrote down. And the question is, what should we be writing down in this course for in general relativity? And so schematically, what we're going to have is something on this side that tells us about geometry, or what we've alluded to is that it's going to be a measure of space-time curvature, where we haven't really defined that very well yet. And so that's going to be one of the goals. But then here on the other side of the equation, we should have some measure of the matter, or the energy density that is producing this space-time curvature. And so some comments about what we should expect to find is that, first of all, what goes over here should be involving second derivatives of the metric, and one reason being that I should see it as an extension of the left-hand side of Newton's equation there, and so that involves second derivatives. But also, when we talked about curvatures, and I'll get back to this before, what we saw is that It was really in the second derivatives of the metric that we couldn't use coordinate transformations to get rid of everything. So the other thing, or another thing in keeping with this, is because it's a relativistic equation and time and space are on an equal footing, rather than just having spatial derivatives, we should actually be expecting to find both time and space derivatives. So that it'll be a covariant equation. The other thing is that here we had, in the Newtonian theory, just a gravitational potential, or a single field, whereas here we've got the metric, a tensor, and so we should expect to find a symmetric tensor's worth, or a tensor's worth of equations or terms here, that are going to depend, or going to determine then, a tensor's worth of metric. So here I'm really saying two things. One is I should find a tensor here, so that's something that has special properties under coordinate transformations. But I'm also looking for not just one equation, but 10 equations to solve for 10 different components of G alpha beta in principle. But if I have 10 things on this side of the equation, then the other thing I should expect is that I need 10 different things on this side. I can't just work with the mass density. I need a tensor's worth of matter stuff on the other side of the equation. And so that's something that I'll leave for later in the week. What I want to focus on now is this side of the equation and what comes in here to replace del squared phi. And the question, or the way I'm going to ease into that, is by thinking about experiments that might be sensitive to space-time curvature, or an experiment. So I'll remind you, first of all, recall the equivalence principle. So what the equivalence principle said was that physics in a freely falling frame was going to be the same as physics in an inertial frame. That is that a physicist making experiments or observations in his lab locally couldn't tell the difference between being either in an inertial frame, which means he's out there in empty space far from any gravitational fields, or he's in a lab that's falling in a uniform gravitational field. So physics is the same in an inertial frame, or inertial frames, or Greeley Falling Frame. In a uniform gravitational field. So this was a profound insight into physics that guided Mr. Einstein's thinking. However, we transformed it or translated it into a mathematical statement about our metrics or our space-time geometry. So in mathematical terms, we made the observation that locally, what I could do is I could always find a coordinate transformation, which was going to take whatever complicated metric I had, and at that point, at least, I could transform it into just g alpha beta equals eta alpha beta. And I could actually work harder, and what I would find is that not only was g alpha beta equal to eta alpha beta, but that the first derivatives of g alpha beta vanished. And so it becomes a rather less impressive statement, but in mathematical terms, then, can find a coordinate transform at any point so that the metric looks like the Minkowski space metric, and those first derivatives were vanishing. And then we went on in our counting exercises to see that, in fact, though we didn't have enough freedom here to get rid of all of the second order derivatives, and so that was then this hint that curvature has to do with second order derivatives of the metric. Here, let me write point. Yes, what's the question?
I'm a lambda page.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's shorthand that I end up using. So that just means an ordinary derivative with respect to x lambda. But we haven't been using that. So I said this was a profound insight. The other statement doesn't seem nearly as profound once you start talking about coordinate transformations. But the fact that we can't get rid of the second derivatives or this discussion about uniform gravitational fields suggests that we look a little more broadly or set up the lab or think about a lab that's slightly larger, and so that we might start to detect inhomogeneities in the gravitational field, or we might detect that, for instance, the gravitational field in this room or in orbit in the space shuttle isn't precisely uniform, but that there are small inhomogeneities. So we're going to consider slightly larger experiments where the non-uniformity of the gravitational field starts to become evident. And so what we're going to do is compare two experiments. We'll think about one being in an inertial frame and the other being freely falling. But we're going to think about freely falling towards I said there towards a planet, but think a real mass or spherically, well, think about spherically symmetric, but with some finite size. So the experiment is going to be that on this side, here's my lab, and I'm going to set up a circle of test particles in a nice circle. And I'm going to do the same thing over here. So this is a circle's worth of test particles, exactly the same radius. This guy, though, is accelerating down because he feels the gravitational attraction of our planet down here. And so the question is, we'll start on the easy side. What does the, so we've set up those test particles and then we let them all go. What does the observer in the inertial frame see? I said it was the easy side, so somebody had better answer now because the other one's harder. Yes, Chris.
They stay in the same circular pattern.
Correct. What the person sees is absolutely nothing happening. So a little while later, I end up with the same circle of test particles neatly arranged in the same circular pattern. So in this freely falling lab, where the field isn't perfectly uniform but has the gravitational field around a spherical mass, what do I expect to see on that side? Aaron? I might, but what do I actually measure? Although you could say that's what I'm measuring with this experiment, but let's not. You already answered your question.
Distortion in the circle.
Okay, why? What kind of distortion?
The center of the circle will feel a higher gravitational field than sides.
That is true. So you're saying that, where am I going to put it? Okay, so what I see here is a force law. So if this is, you know, if I'm doing my experiment in orbit here, I can just use the gravitational force law. And so there's this 1 over r squared dependence. And so what that means is that this particle experiences a slightly larger force than the center, or, well, in fact, any of the other particles. But in particular, this particle experiences a stronger force than that one. And so it accelerates down slightly faster than this one up here. Are there any other distortions? Nima.
Roughly speaking, the force on the sides are not parallel, so.
Right. Because I have a round source here of a finite size, the forces are all pointing towards the center of the mass down there. And so, whereas the forces experienced by these guys at the center are set up so that they're straight down, this one at the side gets pulled slightly inward, and similarly, this one gets pulled slightly the other direction, inward towards the center. And so the bottom line, let's see if we can draw this. If we had had this nice circular pattern, the top mass falls behind because it's experiencing less acceleration. The middle mass is accelerating faster and so gets dragged out of the circle. These two ones at the side are getting pulled in slightly, and then I have to fill out the rest of the circle. So my perfectly circular pattern gets distorted into some kind of elliptical pattern because of those non-uniformities. And we should
at the top you have the inward pull is not going to be as strong because it looks more.
So.
Sorry, it's a minor.
No, but that's a good point. He's complaining about my artwork. That's a good thing to complain about. And so what we should do is some real math. But I just wanted to put some words on the board first. So here was our experiment in the freely falling frame. It's distorted, and there were basically two effects. One is the force law is varying with distance. In particular, we could take the center of that as being the center of mass of the lab, and so there's some average acceleration due to the lab, but the individual masses then, so further masses experience less acceleration, closer masses experience more acceleration. So that was one effect, and the other effect was that the force here, the vector component, isn't straight up and down everywhere, but has a slight inward pull because it's directed always at the center of the planet. So that pulls. And so, I mean, the basic lesson here is that one way to detect these non-uniformities in the gravitational field is basically what we're doing is we're comparing the trajectories of different particles that are sitting nearby in the free fall frame. So this is what we're going to do in a moment using our technology of curved space-time and geodesics. But first, I just want to see what the math would be for Newtonian gravity. So that we're able to compare afterwards. Let's consider the Newtonian problem. And so basically what I have is I'm thinking that I've got a test particle following some trajectory being drawn by some arbitrary gravitational field. And then I've set up another test particle that started nearby, and it's following its own trajectory under the gravitational field that it feels there. So let's say our reference particle so in Newton's law, it's just the acceleration is equal to the gradient of the gravitational potential. So I'm taking d phi by dy, and then I'm evaluating that at y equals x, or I'm evaluating it on the trajectory. So we can, well, we can say that that's our reference particle. Then we have this other fellow nearby. So we compare here's someone who shifted over slightly in the field, and so there's some displacement vector between the two trajectories, and this person is going to satisfy precisely the same equation. But it's now that sum is this is the new position or the new trajectory. And again, I'm going to take this gradient, but now rather than evaluating it here, I evaluate it at the new position. And so what was of interest here was these tiny displacements, or the differences between the two. So I just take this equation, I subtract that equation to get an equation for this displacement. And what I have then is this gradient. Alternatively, what I can do is I can write it as, I'll put brackets around it and write it as the difference between the two gradients at two positions that are slightly displaced from one another. But that difference of gradients, then, if I think of this as an infinitesimal displacement, then that's just something that I can evaluate with a Taylor series. Or I can evaluate this one. If I think of n as being small, I can evaluate this with a Taylor series. And I'll only keep the first term. Alternatively, I can think of this difference of gradients as being a second derivative. In any event, what I get in the next line is minus dyi, where that index is still this one, and then there's a dyj, which tells me the direction of the displacement, or it's contracted with this n here. And then in principle, I could keep lots of other terms, but again, thinking of it as just a small displacement, and we're looking for small deviations here, basically I'll just be satisfied looking at this linear term. And so what it says is that this equation for the difference between those two trajectories is controlled by this set, or this matrix, of second derivatives of the gravitational potential. So so it's giving us a measure of the forces that pull the two masses either closer or further apart. And that gets, well, the name we commonly assign to that is that those are the tidal forces. Yep.
Be NXI or XI on the YI?
Ah, sorry. Yeah, no, I took the difference between this equation and that equation.
Is it meant to be a plus then, right?
It was a plus sign until I put big brackets around it. So there's minus and plus. And I'm just doing that to show you that it's the difference between these two gradients. And here I've got second and higher order terms that I'm collecting. Another thing to notice that we're going to use or be guided by is that in our Newtonian equation, it was precisely second order derivatives that entered in on the left-hand side. So this matrix of tidal forces is precisely what enters into Newton's equation. So there we had del squared phi equals 4 pi g times the mass density. But the point is that what that is just the trace over, well, I'm picking this out and calling it an interesting matrix, but it's precisely just the trace. Matrix of second derivatives. And in particular, I could use the words that in the absence of matter, or in the vacuum, the matrix is trace free. That is, if I put a zero on this side of the equation, then this is saying that this matrix that determines the tidal forces is a traceless matrix. So that's the Newtonian problem. Are there any questions about that, Chris?
Just a real minor question here. I noticed you aren't putting any squares on the partials there. Well, I was just wondering if there is some.
No, there's nothing deep there. I'm just being.
Okay.
You're neglecting the mixed derivative.
So, which
derivative? A mixed derivative of phi by taking just the sum over there. Your definition of the tree is there. You, GYI, GYJ. Are you taking the mixed derivative to be zero?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing this. Are you taking the? The idea was I was just working in Cartesian coordinates, so the metric is delta ij. Is that the question?
I was wondering why the mixed partials are zero. Why the off diagonals are zero?
No, they're not. They're not. This equation only constrains the trace. And so I'm not saying in the vacuum, I can't say that there are no tidal forces. What I can say is that you know, the matrix that determines the tidal forces has no trace. I mean, this is an example where, you know, I'm only taking into account the gravitational field of the planet down here, and so there are no matter sources that I'm using, but I'm seeing a tidal force. But if I calculate, I mean, this effect is due to this matrix here. And if Chris wants to get a completely accurate picture, he has now the technology to figure this out. But it's an example where this matrix is not vanishing, but the point is, because I'm solving Newton's equation, it's going to be tracery.
If Newton's equation there says nothing about the off-diagonal components of that object, how do you go about finding the,
I'm not saying anything too deep here. What I'm saying is, here's an equation. Hopefully it's an equation you're used to and you're happy with. It's a differential equation, you know, with appropriate boundary conditions, I can solve for phi.
And then I just evaluate it,
and then I can talk about, you know, how different test particles move around in that gravitational field. Okay. So this was an exercise then in evaluating, these nearby trajectories, but we also get this hint here to think about the trace of this matrix that's determining the tidal forces. So now what we would like to do is we'd like to do the same thing, but think about geodesics and curved space-time geometry. So we repeat. And the equation that we're going to derive has a special name, and so it's called the equation of geodesic deviation. But we start with the same kind of a picture that I had before. There's some reference trajectory. Because we're in this context now, we're talking about geodesics and space-time, rather than talking about the time coordinate or Newton's absolute time, we're going to refer to the proper time as the thing that actually parameterizes the equation. The tangent to our equation at any point is the four velocity, of course. And u dot u is minus 1. So this is our reference geodesic. And then intuitively, we just have the notion that what I want to do is I want to have a nearby geodesic, and I want to see how the separation changes as they both move through the space-time. And so what I need is then this vector that points from one to the other. And we'll call that n in the same way we did before, but now n is a four vector. And so there's some question as to, well, how do I decide which four vector I really use? Or in particular, what's the time component of this vector? How do I decide what a good choice for the time component of the vector is? So So we have a four vector. And basically, we want to know, how do we really fix that? The time component, or the fourth component of this. And so some options, or some choices we could make. A nice simple one would be to say that the inner product of the four velocity with n is equal to 0. Or we could just say that the time component is equal to 0 in our favorite coordinate system. But the bottom line is that those details don't really matter. So we make some choice. And the fact that these details don't matter is actually the subject of your homework problem tonight. Although Hartle doesn't make it particularly obvious if that's what he's talking about. Basically, the idea is that if I'm displacing the endpoint here along the geodesic by a little bit, I'm just shifting it a little bit by the four velocity. And what you'll show is that when you make small shifts like that, it's not going to affect the answer that will derive in half an hour or so. So we're just going to make some choice. Given that prescription, what we want to know then is, how does n vary as it evolves with the proper time? But more precisely, what I want to know is, what does the observer on our reference geodesic measure for that variation? So I'm thinking of an experiment like this. What does the observer actually measure? What does he see? And since we're talking about what does an observer measure, we have to introduce one of those orthonormal frames. Yeah, we will. Or we'll be looking at the components of n. Those are the things that we would measure in this frame. But we're going to have a little bit of discussion, which amounts to asking, well, I'm moving along the geodesic. Maybe the frame is shifting as well as n. And so how do I figure out how the observer's frame is moving around as he moves along the geodesic. So again, there's a collection of four basis vectors, and those A's are labeling which one of the vectors, and if I take the inner product, orthonormal means that they all have unit norm and they're orthogonal, so I get this Minkowski A to AB there. I've actually given you one of the one of the basis vectors, in that the best or the simplest choice, the only choice for E0 is the four velocity along this geodesic. So zero hat is just the four velocity along our reference. And it satisfies, of course, this, well, you get the desired u dot u as a minus 1. But then I've got my spatial basis vectors. So I'll just label them with 1, 2, 3, or I call that I hat there. And as I said, there's some ambiguity into making that choice, and we have to make an appropriate decision on how we're going to set up our basis vectors, because we're not just sitting at a point now, we're doing an experiment where we're evolving or we're moving along the geodesic. So there's some, again, ambiguity in setting up the bases. Along the entire geodesic. But what we would like to preserve, or what we're going to demand, is that this relation holds for whatever choice we make at every point along the geodesic. So for these spatial basis vectors, the inner product is a delta ij, i.e. they have norm 1 everywhere and they're orthogonal. And they're also orthogonal then to our time-like vector or to the four velocity. So that's just saying I want that to hold everywhere along the geodesic. Is there a question there?
No.
So the question is, what's a nice prescription that we can use to achieve that result? And the first observation I'll make is that, well, we know how to evolve this one forward. The time-like one is determined by the geodesic equation. This is a geodesic. The geodesic equation tells me precisely how u evolves as I move forward. So remember that what we had was an equation that looked like this. What did I write? Beta mu. So this is our geodesic equation, but then this is precisely the four velocity, and this is the first derivative of the four velocity. So I can rewrite that as so this is a first-order equation that I could use, in principle, to follow my basis, my time-like basis vector forward along the geodesic. And then I had this constraint Well, then I had this constraint here. As just to simplify the notation and minimize the typos on the board, I'm just going to write E where I mean any one of the spatial indices. So I'm going to drop writing an I hat or something like that. So what I have is the equation E tilde dot U tilde equals zero, or that is G alpha beta E alpha U beta. Or it's going to be handy just to think of this as that combination as turning this vector into a covector or into one form. Yeah. And so I'll write that as E beta, U beta. So this is, these are just, well, I've just lowered the index again using the metric. And it'll turn out that'll be, well, that'll be the simplest thing to write an evolution equation like this in terms of, and it'll also be the thing that we use in talking about our measurements in any event.
Basis in terms of the lowered indices, and that then lets us.
Well, I'm going to do, I'll show you what I'm going to do next. I'm just saying this is just, I've lowered the index. Now, what I can do is I can say that, well, this is supposed to be zero everywhere, so d by d tau of that equation has to be equal to zero. And so but what that means then is that just using the chain rule, that d by d tau of those components of our basis vector contracted with the four velocity plus this object contracted with the derivatives of the component of the four velocity are equal to zero. So this is something that I'm looking for. This is something that I happen to have written down just a couple lines up here. And so what I can do is just take this and plug it in there. And what we end up with then is there is a U beta that's contracted with, in this term, that first derivative. And then I'm just going to take that here and replace by this collection of things, a Christoffel symbol and two U's. And I'm going to pull the U beta out. So let's see what I have left over. There's a minus sign, E alpha beta mu, E alpha beta U mu equals zero. I think I got that right. Yeah, okay. So this is in, well, this equation says that this collection of objects dotted with the four velocity is equal to zero, but it's also, that looks like an interesting equation that would allow us to propagate or to evolve our basis vectors forward. And so what I'm going to say is that the simplest choice to make is rather, is just to set what's in the brackets equal to zero. So again, that's not what that equation says. It doesn't say that the quantity in brackets is equal to zero. It says that it's orthogonal to the four velocity. What I'm saying, though, is it, what we're doing is we're looking for a nice prescription, and that's a particularly handy one. In some sense, it parallels what I see here in this equation. And again, this was the time-like vector. So one has to check, though, a number of things. So the proposal for the evolution of our basis vectors is that the covariant components evolve as alpha, beta, mu, e sub a, alpha, u, mu. Now, I've done a bunch of things, or there are some things you have to check. I actually jumped ahead, and I said that this equation also applies for the zeroth component. This isn't quite the equation that we have here, because here the indices are raised, there the indices are lowered. And so one has to check that this also, that equation also applies when I'm talking about the covariant components of the four velocity. And I'll just claim that that's true. The other thing that we have to check is that this equation actually preserves this orthonormality condition. Here, what we showed is that the fact that it's that the spatial ones are orthogonal to the time-like basis vector naturally follows. But we also had to check that each one, you know, the x vector was orthogonal to the y component or the y vector, et cetera. So you can check that this is compatible. With that other constraint. So here we just use one of the constraints for inspiration. And so there's some extra math that I'm not going to do at the board that says that, in fact, that equation is a natural equation, or this natural inspiration gave us an equation that's compatible with everything that we wanted. So that was actually an aside. What we wanted to see is how does this, or what we observe about this separation vector, how does that evolve? To set that up, though, for the observations, we needed this orthonormal basis, and so we needed to know something about how the basis vectors are evolving. And so this is the prescription that we're going to use. So the first thing that we are going to do is, as Chris suggested, we're going to project onto our basis vectors. So the components, well, so n is a four vector, na basis vectors, but that means then that NA is just equal to blah, blah, blah. No, that's not correct. Let me write some of this out. So for the spatial components, I just take the inner product. Again, for the zeroth component, there's this extra minus sign. But what I can do is I can get rid of that minus sign by lowering that index. If I think of these as those components, I can lower the index using 8AB. And so I'll write that out. And what that does then, basically, the only thing it does is it gets rid of that minus sign so that I can write the nice equation. But the thing to beware of is there was a minus sign hidden there, and so I've taken that into account with some new notation. But basically, what I want is the analog of the equation we had before, where we saw in the Newtonian case it was the second derivative with respect to t. Now I want the second derivative with respect to tau. And so what I would like to do is write n sub a. And, well, what I will do here is I will say, this was an alpha EA alpha. So is that step clear? All I'm doing is I'm writing it out in coordinate. Hidden in there, though, there's a G alpha beta. Because remember, these guys, I think of them as contravariant vectors or vectors with upstairs indices, and so I've hidden the G in there to so that it's all a downstairs index.
You mean the
eta? Yeah, I did that here, but I'm doing the same thing. Okay, let me write it there. So ordinarily I would say this, like that, and so I'm just doing the same thing I did before. Remember when we had the this equation, we ended up with the downstairs index by combining those two. And wrote it like that. But that's handy because what I have here is an equation for the covariant components, not the contravariant components. So let's see if I can write that out then. So all I'm going to do is I'm going to take two derivatives of that expression there. So there's the first term where the derivatives both act on the n. Then there's the cross term. And then there's derivatives both acting on our basis components of the basis vector. And so what do I have? have to do. I have to think about how to evaluate that term, the second derivative with respect to of n with respect to tau. We have here first derivatives. We're kind of just going to keep those. We have something I can substitute for that, because that was just this. And though then I also want to worry about, well, I have a first derivative there, but what's the second derivative of that term, or those components of my basis vectors? So I also have to worry in a moment about how can I replace that in a nice way. But I can, well, yeah, we'll get there when we get there. So I said I wanted to worry about that, first of all. And, well, this was telling me something. Remember, N was telling me something about neighboring geodesics. So we're going to follow the same logic that we had before. For the Newtonian case, what we looked at was just the equation governing the two trajectories. And so there's this equation, first of all, beta. So here's our geodesic equation. It tells me how the reference trajectory evolves. But then I can just write the same equation for our neighboring trajectory, where it becomes x alpha plus n alpha. I have the connection, the Christoffel symbol, rather. But now I'm evaluating it a little bit away from there. And so I should write here that the argument of this is not actually x, but it's x plus n. And then I've got the first derivatives up there. But again, those are first derivatives now of just x plus n. And so what we do, as before, is just take the difference of those two equations. And the second derivatives of x cancel in the first term. And so that leaves me then with this second derivative, which is what I was looking for. And so, well, there's going to be a bunch of terms. But again, what I'm going to do is I'm only going to keep terms that are linear in n. And so there are going to be two contributions where I pick up one of the dn by d tau terms. And so if I put it on the other side of the equation, there is an alpha beta mu. There's a term like that. So again, what I've done is I'm taking things linear in n. And so in this term, I'm taking the first derivative there. I can just evaluate that at x. And this one just gives me the dx by d tau. But there's a factor of 2 here, because there are actually two terms. And if you remember, this object is the Christoffel symbol is actually symmetric in beta and mu. And so both of those terms end up being the same contribution. And so that's why there's this 2. The other term is because I'm evaluating the other linear term. I take those just as the four velocity, but I'm evaluating this slightly away. And so what I get is a derivative, say d by dx delta of that connection, or of the Christoffel symbol. That's evaluated on the trajectory, and then there's the two factors. Like that. Yep. There should be, yes. Thank you. So again, that's coming from, because I'm making this small displacement, and so the derivative's in the n direction. Alternatively, I'd better have something to soak up that extra index. So that's telling me then what I can substitute in for A. But then there was this term, which is a second derivative of the components of our basis vector. But I'm going to do the same, I'm not going to do the same thing. We had an equation for derivatives, first derivatives, and so we just take another derivative thereof, and what we have then but that was precisely then this Christoffel symbol. I've just used that equation that propagated our basis vectors forward and stuck it, well, I've stuck the result in there. And then what I want to do is I want to take the tau derivative, which is a bit of a nuisance. Okay, so that tau derivative just acts on each one of those factors. So there's a tau derivative of the Christoffel symbol. There is Christoffel symbol, tau derivative of the four velocity. So, tau derivative of our Christoffel symbol, the tau derivative acting on the four velocity, tau derivative acting on the components of the basis vector, and all of those indices, which are completely illegible, are the same in every one of those equations. So here, what does this mean? Well, I have a derivative of something that contains metrics and derivatives of metrics. Those things depend on positions. And so what is that saying? That's saying, how does that Christoffel symbol evolve as I move along here? And so the way that derivative acts is by acting on the x's, and I'm evaluating the Christoffel symbol at different points along the trajectory. So what that term means, essentially, is dx delta d tau. And then there's a gamma beta data. Here I've got the first derivative of u, but I had written the geodesic equation in a way that let me replace that, or I had an equation for this derivative in terms of a Christoffel symbol. So before I forget, this is just u delta. This is the four velocity. But then that next term, let's write it out. Gamma, beta, alpha, mu. But then I want to replace that. And there is going to be so this was just using the geodesic equation. We also had an equation that said, how do the components of the basis vectors evolve forward? And so I can replace that one. And so if we look at all of those terms, what we find is that there are two four-velocity terms. And there's a factor which is the components, the components of the basis vector. And then there's a big mess. So the first term involves first derivatives of the Christoffel symbol. The next two terms involve some quadratic terms involving multiplying together two Christoffel symbols and contracting the indices in some particular way. So let's see if we can do that. There's a minus. There is an alpha delta gamma delta mu. So there's some collection of terms, but we have to make sure that the indices are contracted in a very precise way. This was only a piece of the answer. There was another piece of the answer here. There was a third term, the cross term. But if I put that all together, what we end up with can be written in a very nice way. The second derivative of this particular component of our separation vector is equal to some big mess, which we write as beta gamma alpha delta u gamma u delta a beta n alpha. And so this is what's called the equation of geodesic deviation. And I'll have to define that. I've taken the big mess, put it all together in this symbol. Capital R, beta, gamma, alpha, delta. So what do we have? We have two terms, which are first derivatives of the Christoffel symbol, and then there are two terms which are just contractions of a pair of Christoffel symbols. And so this is this nice package. Well, I've put it together in that way because this nice package is, in fact, a tensor. So it's, that tensor is called the Riemann curvature. The thing that's of interest is it appeared in this experiment that we did in this covariant context to measure nearby geodesics. And so what this expression is telling us about is the tidal forces in this nice geometric context. Yeah.
One of these deltas is a gamma.
Which one is a gamma? What is that? Yeah. So it tells us about our tidal forces in this geometric context. I guess we're only going to talk about that later. But it has, right now it looks like a big mess. One of the comments is, though, that remember that these Christoffel symbols, each one of those, there's an equation for that in terms of metrics and first derivatives of metrics. And so these two terms here both involve second derivatives of metrics. And so by combining those second derivatives along with various first derivatives, what we've done is we've got a covariant package, or we've got a tensor package now that tells us about the space-time curvature. So it contains second derivatives of G alpha beta. In principle, there are four indices here. Each one of those indices can have four different values. So you might think that they're, in fact, 256 different numbers. But we know that can't be right, or The suggestion is that that can't be right, because when we did our counting before, what we found was there were only 20 different second derivatives that we couldn't get rid of. And so it turns out that it has various symmetries, which we'll talk about next day, which reduce the counting from 256 components down to just 20 components. The simplest symmetry that's obvious here is that if I focus my attention on alpha and gamma, and if I got the math right here, oh no, I did, correct. So if I focus my attention on alpha and gamma, what I see is that if I interchange those two indices, I pick up a minus sign, because these two terms are alpha and delta, yeah. So listen to what I'm pointing to, not what I'm saying, sorry. So alpha and delta, there's an anti-symmetry, which is obvious in these first two terms, but it should also arise when I interchange alpha and delta in these last two terms there. So symmetries, e.g., what do I have? Beta, gamma, alpha, delta. The last comment, which I'll remind you of tomorrow, is that our equation here, our geodesic deviation, takes the form that I have the second derivative of some components are equal to some matrix times an n. And I've made approximations to reduce it down just to the linear term here. But if you recall, what we did in the Newtonian problem is we said that we took this matrix of tidal forces, and that at least for the vacuum equations, what entered into Newton's equations for the gravitational potential was then just the trace of this matrix. And so we're going to follow the same, we're going to follow that hint and produce then an equation for what the gravitational field, or what should determine the gravitational field, at least in the vacuum. But we've run out of time. So we'll return to that at the beginning of next day. So let's suggest a particular set of equations for the vacuum, or Einstein's equations in the absence of matter. So we'll leave it there for now, unless there are any questions. If not, Callum wants to tell you what's happening this afternoon, I can tell.
A very nice announcement. We've got your statistical physics textbooks are here, so you pick them up on the way out of the room from Venice, I guess. Has anyone seen Chang'an today? He's not here. Does anyone know where he is?
Oh, Chang'an is
here. Oh, he's there. Sorry, we were trying to find you earlier. Okay, so is anyone here?